Welcome back to Word Up with Dani Katz. I am your host, Dani Katz. I am an author, journalist, and a quantum languaging coach and consultant. What that means is that I teach people how language programs consciousness, how language programs reality at large, and how to transform reality and evolve our consciousness with language. I've also been known to cultivate and share an opinion or two or 12 about culture and consciousness and how they are evolving, devolving, and being manipulated by the powers that were. Here at Word Up, we are devoted to fostering critical thinking while supporting you in becoming your most authentic, empowered, liberated, realized, amazing version of yourself. Our every show aims to expand your consciousness, raise your frequency, sharpen your critical thinking skills, and make you giggle. And think. Given the radical uptick in censorship over the past few years, combined with the complete co-opting slash decimation of my own personal industry, journalism, I started Word Up to have a free speech-friendly platform in which to engage exploratory, solutions-based conversations with visionaries, mystics, original thinkers, and rebel badasses who are helping to make the world more wonderful. The first half of my interviews run between 30 to 90 minutes and are always posted here for free public listening. The second halves are reserved for paid supporters on my Patreon and my Locals platforms, where for as little as $5 a month, you can access all of my second half conversations along with oodles of other bonus content and opportunities to drop in with me, to drop in with our High Vibe tribe, and lots of other awesome things. In addition to interviews, Word Up also features quantum languaging upgrades, planetary service announcements, and propaganda analysis, which I call Spot the Propaganda. Thank you so much for tuning in and for sharing your sacred attention with me and our High Vibe tribe of change makers. Be sure to click that subscribe button so you can stay abreast of our every episode. Thank you for also clicking the like button, for sharing far and wide, and for leaving some kind words as a review as you are authentically inspired. As well, if you are gleaning any value whatsoever from these shows, consider supporting me on Locals and or Patreon. And as you are wanting to learn more about my quantum languaging coaching and consulting services or nab copies of my books, find me on DaniKatz.com as well as on quantumlanguaging.com. Okay, I think that's it for our housekeeping. Buckle up and prepare to enjoy this episode of Word Up with Dani Katz. Is Mike Winner your real name?
That is. I was born a winner.
Where does that come from? How did your family adopt such an auspicious moniker?
It's kind of a mystery, to be honest. We have a kind of a weird past in my father's. My great-grandfather, we don't really know a lot of his history. And my grandfather was raised by on the reservation in Montana by Blackfeet Indian. And he was like kind of very separated from the history of that lineage. And my dad's done some research into it. But to be honest, it's still kind of a mystery where the winner comes from. There are other winners we bump into. But yeah, it's something I should probably research more. But my father's line goes far back. He's been able to trace it back to like Scottish family line back into the 1600s and stuff. But yeah, it's definitely interesting name, right?
Totally. Do you think it's given you a leg up on life because of the incessant programming of calling yourself a winner all day, every day?
I would say so. Like so it's funny because it was definitely a name you have to live up to, especially as a teenager, because of course, you know, every kid that wants to hate on you is going to call you loser. And I had a lot of coaches too do the same. So yeah, it was, It was interesting in most classrooms too, they do everything alphabetically. So while I was, in my mind, always know I was a winner, I was usually always last because I was a W. But that being said, yeah, it was, I definitely think it has really played a massive role in my life and where I'm at today. And I have two boys, two young sons that were born winners, and my wife became a winner when she married me. And it's a constant running joke, but we have a lot of fun with it, and we take great pride in the name.
Awesome. It's such a good one. I've been envious for most of my adult life of Nigel Godrich. I'm like, what an amazing name
Yeah, right.
to be born with. But winner, yeah, it's so super potent.
It really is. And yeah, I mean, that's my DJ name. People ask, like, what's your DJ name? I'm like, well, I was born with an awesome DJ name. So I just go by, I mean, I've changed it over the years from DJ Winner to just Mike Winner, DJ Mike Winner. But yeah, I've always been, because I've been a DJ for like 25 years. So yeah, it just works well on all facets of life. And yeah, but obviously coaches in high school had a field day with it, and it's and also a lot of people when I was younger didn't believe our last name was Winner. There was like a cognitive dissonance when they'd see it, so they'd call us Wiener or Winer or Winter, and so it's like I always have to say no, opposite of loser, and not opposite of summer, opposite of loser. And there's even a funny joke my friends know of when I had was called into court as a potential witness for a crime that my friend was assaulted, and the judge had a problem with my last name, so I said no, opposite a loser, and like in the middle of the courtroom, and got a huge chuckle on that. So yeah, it's a funny one for sure.
So I want to talk about, well, of course I want to talk about Cordal, which I always mistakenly pronounce as Cortal for some reason. And then we can get into Music and Sky and some other things that you're working on. But as far as Cordal, am I saying it right?
Like it's like portal with a Q. Yeah.
Okay. So were you always a rebel weirdo, or did something happen along the way that inspired you to like pull yourself out of consensus societal meanderings?
That's a great question. I definitely was always the kid in my imagination that was not fitting in, that always felt sort of like the odd man out in many ways, and always struggled with reality. And I didn't understand why things work the way they do. And growing up in Orange County, California, which is sort of like this, very much a modern concrete jungle of consumerism, if you're familiar with that area at all, where it's just strip mall upon strip mall of Disney-fied reality, I often found my escape from that because I felt that that just wasn't right. Like humans aren't meant to live like that. And from a very young age, and I was very tapped in from a very young age. I had some weird trauma at a very young age that I haven't really even spoke about much because it's kind of weird sexual trauma. That it wasn't anything like I was sexually abused or anything. It was just with peers of my age in kindergarten. And so it opened me up into sexuality at a very young age. And it just, I think I felt like the world was not a place that is right. And so I went into my imagination, and I loved my imagination. And my dad, my father, love him to death. He was born a winner too. He would chastise me for like, get your head out of your clouds. I'd always be behind the crowd with my head down, looking, or my head up in the clouds, and I wasn't really present. I was very much a child in a fantasy world. And I think that was my form of escapism from what I saw as a monotonous, boring, drone-like existence of modernity. And then that led into my rebel punk years, where I really gravitated towards punk rock. And I was a punk rock kid in high school and would go to punk shows coming up in Orange County. And also was really into ska. The third wave ska scene was really big then. Actually, we have a mutual friend, Mike Wan, who's an MW as well. We're both MWs. And we were talking about this at a freedom event at Jim Gale's farm. in November about the 90s and coming up in that scene of music. And actually, that was a very much an escapism type of music. A lot of people just see that as silly. Like you think of, okay, like No Doubt is probably the most famous band from that time, when before they went Gwen Stefani pop. And then there was other bands like in the East Coast, Mighty Mighty Boss Tones. But in our end, we were kind of in the mecca of that in Orange County. Third wave ska exploded out of there. And as a reaction to that consumerism, that just, and it was very much like a white bastardization of ska, which came out of, obviously out of Jamaica, that actually most don't even know that's where reggae came from. Ska was before reggae. But that being said, it was very much an escapist musical trend of just going and dancing, going to a show that was silly, upbeat music, and just to forget about all the worries of the world and get lost in the dance we called skanking. And then, of course, with punk rock, it was all about, you know, getting rid of all the angst and everything of modern life through moshing and going anti-establishmentarian. And I loved both those aesthetics. So I was really into punk and ska in high school. And then that got me into rave culture as I got a little older. And that was exploding in Los Angeles, especially, and, you know, warehouse parties and house music and all that. And that's when I really gravitated towards DJing and going to underground mountain parties and breaking into warehouses and all that. And it was still a sort of a punk rock ethos, but it was very much now plur, like peace, love, unity, respect. I was growing up in my spirituality a little more, coming out of an all boys Catholic high school in Orange County. And so, yeah, I was always though seeking a path of, I don't know, finding myself out of the system. And I think that's why I've always gravitated towards being a conspiracy theorist and being anti-establishmentarian, being very much a rebel in terms of like never holding down a 9-to-5 job for more than 6 months. You know, like I've now been successfully an entrepreneur since 2005. So just refusing to work for anyone, you know, trying to embrace that moniker of Sigma male as much as I can. We're really as independent minded as I can and not bowing down to authority. So when I discovered this concept of Bitcoin in 2010 or 11 through sort of my libertarian circles, I was fascinated by it. I thought it was super cool, but I didn't really catch on to the power of actual, like, the technology and how it works. I understood the philosophy of it early on, but I didn't really start gravitating towards the technological elements of it and how powerful it is till around 2000, I would say 15, 16, and then really started nerding out in 2017, 18, when I got involved with what became Cordal.
And there's so many pieces. I grew up in LA as well. So SoCal is like its own kind of formative years.
And if you don't mind me asking, what were your formative years? Like, were you a 90s kid, a 2000s kid, or what was your?
I was more an 80s kid.
Really? You look phenomenal for being an 80s kid, I will say. Well, I was kind of an 80s kid too. So I was born in 78. I'm the last of the X-Geners. The 80s really resonate with me still. Like, I'll be playing an 80s set at Music and Sky. I really love 80s music. But that's interesting because the 80s was like a really unique time for punk rock in LA, especially.
Yeah. I was going to request the 70s set with the 80s fashion sense, but we'll make it work. Yeah. I mean, I'm Gen X as well. So I think we're probably similar. We're the same, you know, same age range. Growing up, it was like Orange County had this really bad reputation of being like Republican and white supremacist. And compared to the rest of the West Coast ethos, it was kind of like that redheaded conservative stepchild that just got a bad rap for everything. Was that your experience growing up there?
Well, it's funny because I was kind of coming out of that. We were in a trans, you know, and it's totally different now, by the way. It's gone totally blue, of course. But yeah, definitely, definitely. There was a sensibility around that still. It was very much red. It was conservative, family values, very white. I mean, you had your massive pockets though of like Latinos in Santa Ana, where I went to high school at Servite. It was in Anaheim. I mean, I remember seeing like, tranny, like Latino weird flyers on the ground when we'd go to lunch, like I was in a very Hispanic neighborhood there. So actually Orange County was very multi cultural still then. And then a huge in Westminster, a massive Vietnamese population, the largest outside of Vietnam. So actually I think that's a little bit of a, a bad rap, but it did tend to be conservative. And actually it's funny, like I had massive Orange County pride coming out of high school, due mainly to like the ska scene and going to Disneyland every day. I was like a Disneyland regular. My first job was at Disneyland. And at
Wait,
that,
what'd you do? What'd you do? What was that first job?
so my dream job was to work ODV, outdoor vending, selling churros, because that's where all the babes were. Working, and there was a blonde, beautiful blonde that sold balloons that I told all my friends I was going to go out, take her out. I was going to ask her out by the end of summer, and I was going to get a job at Disneyland to win her over because she denied me. And I told her, I want to take you out so bad. I mean, this was the ultimate, the penultimate Huntington Beach surfer blonde, right? I just saw her every time and like fell in love with her. And so funny, I ended up taking her out at a date at Disneyland later, but I got a job at Disneyland, but I was overly qualified because I was a dang winner. So I got into my mom's best friend's husband, who was a good family friend, was the head of security at Disneyland. And so he got me in on like a high level interview, and I got in, was hired as like a merchandising kid, like to do merchandising, the youngest ever in the history of Disneyland, I guess. At 16, I was doing like the merchandising in the stores, like setting up, designing how like the plush Mickey Mouse dolls were gonna look and things. So I was literally working with 65-year-old grandmas in Toontown. Wearing an, the most ridiculous costume, and all I wanted to be doing is wearing that awesome red jacket and selling churros with all the high school babes. So that is probably a phenomenal microcosm of my life right
Were
there.
you there when they still had the Monsanto in, sponsored shrinking ride?
Wait, fill me in on this. Which
Like
one's?
the journey to space, and it was sponsored by Monsanto. And it was like you rode the same cars that you rode in the Haunted Mansion, but everything
Okay.
was like you were shrinking the whole time until ultimately, like you were smaller than a snowflake. And I
Oh
mean,
my
they did
God,
away with
I
it at
don't.
some point.
Was that in Tomorrowland? I don't
It
know if I
must
remember.
have been Tomorrowland.
Holy mackerel. I don't remember that. I do not remember that. Must have been early 80s or something, because I was working there in 94. 94 through 96. The people mover was still kicking, until someone died and they had to take that out. You still had the thing where you get on the people mover and it'd take you through Tron and all that stuff. It still had the they had just gotten rid of the what do you call them? The you ride over all of Disneyland on a wire, and it would go through Matterhorn.
Like the old funiculars.
They have them in like Switzerland and stuff. But I
Totally.
guess people were throwing stuff off those. I mean, we were guilty of throwing gummy bears off those and stuff. But those were awesome. Like they got, yeah. So I was right there when the old Disneyland was kind of ending. The new Disneyland was kind of coming up where they were getting more sort of before Marvel and stuff, but it was starting. You could start to see that commercialization really kick in with Star Wars and things. But yeah, they still, when I was going there, they had a disco band in Disney in Tomorrowland that would come out of the ground every night on every hour, and they'd play like a 15-minute disco set, and we would go and skank and dance. And Tomorrowland was all full of like, this was before quote unquote hipsters. This was punk rock and ska kids and stuff, smoking cloves and wearing dickies and creep, what are those called? Creepers or whatever. And and like there was like also the rockabilly kids and the straight edge kids. And we would just take over all of Tomorrowland, and it was just a big teenage hangout.
That sounds awesome.
That's
Best use
why Gwen Stefani titled that their second album after Trapped in the Box, which is funny. Their first album is called Trapped in a Box,
Mm-hmm.
right? In the box of commercialism of Orange County. And then the second album was Tragic Kingdom. play off the Magic Kingdom.
Oh, I had no idea that that was a Disneyland reference. I feel
Yeah,
so much
we
smarter.
used to kick it with them at Disneyland, the No Doubt Gang. I had a massive crush on Gwen Stefani. She was like 2 or 3 years older than I am. And when we, yeah, I'd see her, be like, oh, there's Gwen. I had friends that knew her and stuff. But yeah, it's such a funny scene. So I came out of Orange County like all like OC Pride. Remember at this time in the mid 90s, because I went to UC Santa Barbara, University of California, Santa Barbara. Did you really? You're a gaucho?
I was a gaucho cheerleader.
Oh, wow. For the basketball team? Because they didn't have a
Yeah.
football team.
Yeah,
Yeah.
for our basketball team. Back when it was good, we had a really good team when I was there.
We were good when I was there. We went to the tourney. I almost walked on the basketball team.
Really?
Yeah, I played ball at Servite.
Oh, that's impressive because that was a really good team there.
Division one, yeah, we had Baby Peyton on the team. It was Gary Payton's cousin, and I mean, I don't know if I would have made the team. I used to go play at the rec center all the time against them, and my buddy Pat, DJ Pat, he was like a 6'6" guard, and I was a shooting guard, and we were just having a pickup game against them, and I was lighting it up, hitting every shot, and the coach came up to him more than me and was like, "Do you guys want to try out?" And I was a freshman, top peak shape of my life. And I was really into punk and skating and DJing. I was like, those are my priorities, bro. I didn't come here to play ball and like have my life sucked away, by that. So, but that's so funny. Who else? I was just talking to somebody else who was a gaucho who does podcasts. I can't remember who it is, but, that's great. So, you were there probably when it was primo crazy Isla Vista party time.
It was primo crazy Isla Vista party time, and I was such a nerd who like didn't drink, had never smoked pot. Like I took part in none of those things, but I had a great time because it was back when it was still the law in Isla Vista that you couldn't have any like corporate chains. So
Oh,
it had
wow.
that like really chill kind of
I love it.
quiet vibe. Yeah.
Free birds, baby. Free
Oh,
birds.
Freebirds was so good.
Yeah, Tio Alberto's. That might have even been there when you're there. They had the biggest burritos known to man for like $4. It'd be like three meals. And then you had Javon's sandwiches. See, it's, I know all the spots. You had Sam's to go. Like it was, you're right. It was all mom and pops. And you had, oh, there was that bar in the middle of Isla Vista. I forgot it, what it's called. And yeah, so I lived in IV. That's where I learned how to DJ. I threw house parties there. I ended up then managing and promoting clubs downtown in Santa Barbara. I became a Santa Barbara club DJ downtown, professional. I played 5 nights a week. I met my wife at Wildcat at the Shitty Kitty. Yeah, I was a resident at Wildcat, at Zello. We started our club night at Zello's, if you remember Zello's.
Of course.
Yeah,
I'm
and
forgetting
I was the man in Santa Barbara for years. I did two reality TV shows I produced and tried to sell about Santa Barbara nightlife called State Street and the Bar Life. Almost sold to VH1. Yeah, I was friends with a lot of bar owners and bar, of course, rock star bartenders there and all that. So yeah, the bar life was like really my 20s, and the nightlife of Santa Barbara, and also just the general lifestyle of Santa Barbara, because I was married there. I left in 2008. So I was there from 96 to 2008 with a little stint in LA between, when I graduated and then I came back. But yeah, I did all the things like going out and day parties on yachts and mansion after parties in Montecito. And, my friends became really good friends with billionaire kids and, all that thing in Santa Barbara. It's all there, like just like the soap opera from the 80s.
Yeah. That's awesome. I love that you're a fellow gaucho. So, were you into conspiracy stuff then, or when did it click in for you?
Then, so I got into conspiracy stuff in the 90s. Primarily, my father tickled my conspiracy brain a little bit as a youth, because he was very much conservative, Montana boy who was very much into the Constitution, and he was kind of in the early days of the internet involved with the sort of Patriot right groups and stuff that were on these little chat groups and stuff talking about how we're, because he couldn't stand the Clintons, and he could see all the grift and crime and everything going on back then. So he was always chatting in my ear about it. My mom is a total opposite liberal, just very peaceful, lovely lady, but just believes in everything, which is great. Like, it's just how she rolls. And then my dad's like, oh no, they're all gotta shoot the bastards. And so he got me into, like, also he was a psych major and got his master's in psychology and stuff. So, and he was learning about out-of-body experience and stuff like that. So he had gotten me books on that when I was like 14, and I was getting into that sort of more metaphysical reality. And then so that all kind of coalesced into my fascination with aliens, UFOs. And then I've told this story a few times, but I on my lunch breaks when I was working at Nordstrom, right when, yeah, and well, right out of college and in college too, I would go to Borders bookstore there, in Brea, and I would go to the metaphysical, spiritual, religion area on every lunch break, and I just pull out every book I could, like the Carlos Castaneda books, all this stuff on like witches and all that. I was just fascinated because I was a Catholic boy that never knew about this stuff. And then one day this book fell out and fell on my foot. And I picked it up, and it was David Icke. Which one was it? It was like one of his first books, Wake Up. I forgot which one it is, but it was the one about the reptilians and all that. And I was like so hooked. I was too cheap to buy it, so I would bookmark it and hide it in another section of the bookstore that no one would go into. And then I would go back and read it, and I read the whole book there. And then I like just got super into all his books. I've got some right here still. Oh, here's. Funny. See, here we go. Here's a classic, Alice in Wonderland and the World Trade Center disaster. And
I
later on, I would leave these books on purpose in my Santa Barbara roommates, like on the bathroom and stuff, like, hey. So yeah, I was super into conspiracy culture really early on. I got into like Project Camelot and Project Avalon with like Carrie Cassidy and her partner there, and went down all those rabbit holes, the Basis Project, like super into all that stuff. And then it actually was through that and meeting a friend through DJ culture, through DJing, that I was introduced to Bear Lando through his son, who's was a very close friend of mine in college. And then Bear kind of really opened my eyes to the esoteric and sort of the deeper realities that go way beyond conspiracy culture. And I remember like having a talk with him in Santa Barbara at some event about, oh, you know Alex Jones, because my dad had me listen to Alex. He was listening to Alex Jones when he was on radio, and he's like, yeah, Alex Jones, he's just kind of like surface level stuff. This was Bear, Dr. Lando. He's like, yeah, he's kind of surface level stuff. You should, really look into this and this. And it's basically through knowing yourself and through fixing your health. And then that led me into a health journey because I had been suffering from a lot of like annual strep throat and flus, not really flus, but just like stuff. I was getting sick a lot, like I shouldn't be, because I was partying and I was eating fast food, and I just wasn't tapped in to my inner self. And then I had done some mushroom trips in San, you know, at UC Santa Barbara, and obviously with the rave culture, that was tapping me into a lot of things, but not into the sort of deeper work. And then so it was cool. It was like the conspiracy thing took me into the deeper spiritual esoteric stuff. And then that's kind of where I've been ever since.
That's awesome that your dad was so hip to these things and that you got it at such an early age. Was this the Nordstrom in Santa Barbara?
Yeah, it was.
Because I helped open that Nordstrom, and that was the most fun job because it was all just kids from UCSB who worked there, like running wild on all of the floors and having so much fun. And
I
I
wanted to
had.
do a reality show about that because Nordstrom would never allow it to happen. Because I was also a film major, just so I was a double major film and history at UC. They had a really top-notch film theory department there, one of
Definitely.
the top in the country actually. But their production wasn't quite there. But so I was really into. This was the time, remember, when like Laguna Beach had come out and for MTV, and that kind of reality TV was just hitting the scene. And I was like, wow, that. I want to do documentary filmmaking, and I kind of like that culturally. So I was looking to dive into that space. And I was like, how cool would it be to do like a hidden camera or even kind of scripted reality show? Because I was a shoe dog at Nordy's. So I was like, you know, shoe dog, for those out there that don't know the parlance of the Nordstrom, was how Nordstrom started, but it was selling shoes. So those were like the top dogs in the store, besides maybe personal shoppers that made the most money. We sold shoes, and I sold women's shoes in salon and, you know, women's department. I was the man. I was top tier. I took it. I loved it. It's my still my favorite 9-to-5 job I've ever had. I got to dress up in a suit every day. I was 18, or no, I think by the time I started Nordstrom, I was maybe 20. So young strapping lad in a suit talking to women all day and helping them buy shoes. I mean, it was just, it's the greatest job, and it was commission based. So it was like, I got to decide how much money I make by how much I hustle. I met many a ladies that I would go out with from that job. And even older women. And I love women. I always have. I've always put women on a pedestal to the point where I was really shy around them as a kid because I saw them as these like beautiful goddesses. So having this job at Nordstrom where I had an in to talk to every woman that came in all shapes and sizes, I loved it because I've been always fascinated and infatuated with the opposite sex. I've always been girl crazy. So it was so fun.
That was so fun. All the cute guys worked in shoes. And we used to have these like wild, my friend Liana and I, because we worked in Brass Plum upstairs, and we used to have these wild, what's it called when you're looking? We would like hide things.
Like
It was
a scavenger hunt kind of thing,
scavenger hunt.
or
We'd have wild scavenger hunts, and whoever came first would hide this pair of pearls somewhere in some department in the store. We would just have clues all over. It was just such a great job. And especially now that customer service has been so weaponized and
Oh,
is
yeah.
like one of the ways that they're targeting us, I feel like for those of us who worked at Nordstrom, where it was like peak customer service and it was so gratifying to be so devoted, it's just such like a wow, we've come a really long way in terms of the fact that it doesn't even exist anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that's what Nordstrom's famous for. It's like, you know, and I worked at Disneyland too. That was the other thing. It's like the customer's always right at Disneyland too. It's like, or they called it the guest. The guest is always right. It's like you go above and beyond in terms of the customer support and customer relations. And you know, Nordstrom was a wonderful learning place too, to like learn how to engage in an appropriate way. And and you're right, everybody working there was like at the same age and young and partying, and like there was all this drama, everyone was hooking up with everybody. It was wild. Like and Santa Barbara is a party town. Like we would literally get off early on slow days, like some of the crew that was top sellers, and we were all really good friends, and we would go to the little dive bar right there in the mall. I forgot what it was called. And then that would just lead to a crazy day, right? Like we get off at 11 and go to the bars right away in our suits and stuff. And then that would just turn into a whole day. We'd end up at some boat out in the harbor or something. So Santa Barbara was so fun. I'm sure we know mutual people that were, you know, veterans when I was there. And I'm wondering if you ever hung out. You seem like someone that maybe hung out at Chad's. Am I right? Was Chad's there when you were there? Maybe it
I
wasn't
don't
there yet.
remember it. I
Okay.
left Santa Barbara in 93.
Oh
And
yeah,
then I went
Chad's
back
was
to
there.
LA. I went to grad school at USC and I did the same thing you did with a David Icke book at like it was, at the bookstore in the Beverly Center, and I would just go visit it and just like pick it up, plop myself on the floor, continue reading about the lizard people, then go back to whatever job it was at that time. I think I was working at Luke or something.
So you were, we have a lot of parallel similarities here. So you were doing, you know, working retail and reading conspiracy stuff on your lunch. That's phenomenal. So you're old school too. You've been in this for a long time.
So I'm curious to know like how Cordal came to be. Like, what was it that clicked as you started to learn about Bitcoin, as you started to learn about crypto, where you were like, I need to do my own version of this?
Yeah, great question. So for me, when I do get into something, I want to know everything on how it works and the ins and outs and what makes it tick. And I mean, sometimes, like things I'm really passionate about. Like, I don't care about my car. I just got back from an oil change. Like, they do it great. I'm not passionate about that. Like, awesome. It works, cool. But if there's something I'm really passionate about, like when I got really into cooking, I super nerded out on it. I almost was going to go to the Culinary Institute of America and like worked at restaurants in Santa Barbara. Actually, I got really into the restaurant scene in Santa Barbara as well.
Do you remember Piranha?
Of course, I used to kick it in Piranha all the time.
That was my
Yeah.
first waitress job.
Oh, funny. Yeah, that place is the jam.
So
Yeah,
good.
I had friends that worked at like Bouchon, and I worked at a place called Epiphany, which was Kevin Costner's restaurant. And
Fancy.
anyways, yeah, Michael Jackson came in one time and it was a whole deal. Cordal, like I was really intrigued by blockchain once, you know, because I had seen that Bitcoin was tried and true. Like now it'd been out for 5 years, 6 years. There'd been no double spend attacks as people were warning about, which just means that you would have broken the decentralization. Proof of work was working. And proof of work is the consensus that runs the back end of basically the machine of the Bitcoin blockchain database. And it's a phenomenal invention that came out of the Bitcoin white paper. And I was really intrigued by how that all worked, because it just blew my mind that digital money was working in this way that nobody controlled and how powerful that is, right? Like, wow. Because I had read The Creature of Jekyll Island and all that back in the day. Like my dad, oh, that was one of the entry points too. My dad gave me that book in like 99. And so
Nice.
that was a big benchmark moment in my life when I read that book. It blew my mind. And I'm sure everyone listening probably is familiar with that book now, The Creature of Jekyll Island, The True History of the Fed. Yeah, it's your audience is keen on all that. So I was just like, wow, this is really an answer. And I was at that time kind of interfacing in the festival scene a lot as a DJ and in the consciousness scene. And I had a lot of friends that were into crypto and getting into the altcoin space at this time, mainly out of financial means of trading and gains. And I was kind of getting into that too. And like, wow, there's all these other alternatives. You can make a lot of money. And I was like very interested in how that works and what's the dynamics of trading and all that. So I was just really jumping into all of that at that time. And I started to realize, like, you know, well, this was like coming into the big boom of they called the ICO boom of crypto, where, you know, all these new coins are being made and stuff. And it was really interesting to me because it was like alchemy. It was like people are just creating value out of nothing or out of just concepts and stuff. And I was starting to really see, whoa, this is like really scammy. There's like this is like the new frontier, the Wild West of like the new scam era of all this stuff. And so I started to really buckle down and start to study, like, how does this stuff work? Like, how does consensus work? How does proof of work work? How does proof of stake work? All like the functioning of the encryption and all that. And I started to see that, whoa, like there's a lot of problems. Like nothing in this space is actually perfect. Proof of work has problems with centralization at this time. Like there was massive Chinese mining farms that were becoming a threat and getting worrisome. And so I just started going down the rabbit hole of how all this works. And seeing also the dangers on the periphery, and I was already seeing this in 2015, 16, like sort of this transhumanism agenda, where we were going out of, you know, through the like everybody's smartphones and the social media explosion, like people were getting out of touch with being in the physical, being connected. I was seeing it at festivals with people on all on their just using their phones to videotape and in the club scene and everything. It was just like we were getting pulled more and more into the virtual landscape, into the technology. And I was seeing like some sort of red flags with these newer ICOs and stuff that were like coming up with blockchain technology, how to like have your identity on there. And they were centrally sort of launched and controlled through these initial coin offerings. And I was just thinking, wow, actually, this could be the ultimate like honey trap to capture humanity into this technological super state that's all automated and just like the opposite of what the Star Trek dream was. Yeah.
Okay, wait, let's stop there because was that the plot all along? Like, was this set up as that kind as an enslavement trap?
So who really knows, right? We can go deep into a lot of different facets and areas around what started it all, which goes all the way back to DARPNet. I mean, it can go really far back. You could actually trace this all the way back to the transatlanticism of the, mercantile, like James Tunney, who I love, and we've had him on a few times. He's phenomenal at breaking down like where all this comes from. And I think, though, in terms of, yeah, there is always this general narrative and this through this plot, these plot points of that direction of driving humanity by these specific actors, right, into an automated state of just commercialism and essentially slavery. However, in terms of specifically what Bitcoin, for instance, came out of, it's really hard to know because, for one, the writer of it, and I do believe just from looking at the syntax and breaking down a lot of from my studies of what other smart people have said, that it wasn't a single individual who did write that. Now it could be still be a group that came up with it. I know that there was a group that sort of group mind came up with it. But that being said, the technology in and of itself to have a distributed database that is decentralized via computers, to me is just a technology. So it's not a nefarious or good. It's like saying whoever invented the gun or gunpowder had a plan to control all of humanity. It's literally just a technology, and it's a technology that can be used for either great good or great evil. It really can. So, yeah.
Where do you stand on like AI is an extra dimensional intelligence, feeding off of us? Like, how does your perspective on crypto and blockchain in general line up with kind of the various lore around what AI is?
Sure. I mean, that's a huge question, right? That is a 4-hour podcast we could get into. And this will literally comes down to how you break down your epistemological perspective on how we know reality, and ontologically, what is reality, right? And for me personally, in terms of what AI is, yes. So I do believe that we live in a multi-nested reality of it's multi-fractal, and also there are, I don't believe in multi-dimensions per se. We only have three or four dimensions on the that we deal with, but we do have a fractality of vibration and in how we relate to ourselves and to who we are. And in that being so, part of that sort of that those nested worlds, if you will, and this is like metaphysical worlds of vibration of the actual light of intelligence, I call it, or like the light of reality that comes from pure consciousness. In that, there is a form world, right? And in that form world, we create thought forms that can manifest in reality, which Jung would call egregores. And within that, AI is essentially like a thought form egregore that is definitely activated. However, in its initiation, like in terms of code in the realm, that's just a especially digital code, that is always just going to be a simulacrum that is not conscious, that has no consciousness, that is not something that can like take over and be a thing. That is literally we, our consciousness, our literal mental faculties that come from our infinite, eternal self within us are what create those thought forms that drive it. So, so that being said, it's just a technology in the end that when it actually is manifested in the realm, because it's inherently code, and that is a technological construct, just like words. And so those are controlled by our consciousness, no matter what. We are the prime movers and shakers of the realm of the reality. So it, like all gods are the same way. Money is the same way. Money is literally a god. It's a lowercase g god that we give energy and power to when we put our thoughts into it and our beliefs into it. We feed it, and we can be fall prey to it and literally worship it, and it can make us do terrible things. But in the end, we control it when we are conscious of it, with what our powers are. So that's the same with AI. But there is great danger there, because if we don't know what our powers are, and we don't understand how these higher realms work and how our faculties engage, we have these like amazing powers, spiritual powers, to engage through these nested fractal worlds that that are essentially interplaying with us right now. They're overlaying on us right now. Just because we can't physically see them, doesn't mean they're not there, and doesn't mean that they're not playing a massive, that we aren't in them right now, directing things subconsciously, unconsciously. So yeah, long story short, I'm not scared of AI. I'm not really, I don't live in fear at all, but I do, have concerns around the human consciousness forgetting who we are completely, and then just letting our manifestations run wild and rampant. And that's why I'm a huge advocate for freedom, truth, and love. Those are like the three, that's like the trinity, the trivium of Music and Sky, and living in balance there. Because if we can get back to these core principles of finding the ultimate truth, but balancing that in love, so that it doesn't become like my truth's greater than your truth, F you, that's, you know, cult creation, and then balancing that in freedom, so that, in other words, like, you know, we all respect each other to have the freedom to search for our own individual truth, and we balance that out through love, then I think we're going to be okay. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, in the end, AI it's a technology that, like any technology, is being driven by our consciousness. And if we aren't aware of our powers, it can run on programmatically, it could dominate our entire reality if we aren't aware of that.
Mm-hmm. And I just poking a little bit devil's advocate style, but I heard you say that you saw these cryptos creating value. And I'm wondering, like, my perspective on the crypto space as someone who really doesn't understand it is that, like, I'm not sure what value these zeros and ones have, except I see a lot of people like getting in early and playing this kind of old paradigm trading game. You know, like, I remember a few, you know, this was years ago, but I was using some platform that required Bitcoin, and I didn't have any. And so I reached out to friends who had it, and everyone just wanted to hold on to it because it was low. And I'm like, this seems like you're playing an old paradigm game where you're like holding it and waiting for some emergency, but it's not circulating in our communities in a way that feels like the greatest good of all kind of value. It just feels like kind of leftover from the 80s greed is good, but with zeros and ones instead of fat stacks of cash.
Hoarder mentality. No. So when I said value, when I was looking into it, I was seeing that at that time, like, oh, wow, it seems like it's creating value, like, because people are getting in and they're, you know, earning US dollars and getting out and buying things, right? But I quickly got to see that you are dead on. That was playing in the old paradigm of buy low, sell high, screw over your neighbor.
Right.
And I've been very, very vocal about this on shows, speaking about cryptocurrency and blockchain for years, how that is an old world mentality that is basically either a large Ponzi scheme or a trap that the elite wealthy or the wannabe elite wealthy have used for eons to control people, because they have actual assets. And they can play those games easier than those who are trying to play with their fake money. And so, that was a huge turnoff for me when I started to really go deeper spiritually into what this is. And also what is a fundamental principle behind Cordal, which I'll get into, and how it's not about that. And so going back to Bitcoin, the thing that I started to see, the problem with proof of work too, and what you're touching on here, is it's inherently designed to be deflationary, which many like gold bugs and classic Austrian economists see that as the benefit of it. And I always did too, until I started talking about this with some more spiritually inclined people. And actually it was interesting, because it was a gal who's going to be at Music and Sky, Marsha Ann, and she's like a legend in the law space. And not many people know who she is, because she stayed in the private forever. And we were having sort of a deep dive on currency and stuff. And I said, well, isn't like deflationary is that's where you want to go. And she's like, is that actually morally viable option for current? I said, what do you mean? She's like, what happens is you get a hoarder mentality. You get the rich that have the assets hoard it, and then everyone else doesn't want to, as you're saying, share it, and it becomes this greed is good thing, and it becomes sort of a scarcity mindset, right? Scarcity is good, right? That's kind of what drives Austrian economics. And so that seems out of balance to me. Now, the flip side, the Keynesians and stuff who drive our modern monetary policy, they've inverted that, and knowing that, you know, there's problems with that, but they've pushed this almost Luciferian concept that we can have infinite growth and that we live in a place of light and love, that we can just make as much money as we want without any sort of responsibility and create the policy centrally, you know, based upon what's good for man. And that's all smoke and mirrors, of course. That's the same elites doing the same thing. They're just created a whole new centralized monetary policy to trick those who are feel good or that are do-gooders. Like the people that typically supported that are liberals, educated in university, or want to do what's right, right? But they don't have the deeper esoteric understanding of sort of the Luciferian, you know, deception and all that, which just means that it's a pushing on a far other opposite spectrum of the greed and sort of eremonic materialism. There, and this is kind of Rudolf Steiner stuff I'm talking about right now, or like Rosicrucian thinking, but the Luciferian idea is it's pushing this like extreme spiritual escapism where we are just tapped into love and light and going into the 5D, and it's taking out the responsibility of the now and the grounding and the understanding that the spiritual development is actually all about balance, and it's balance between these two. And so, you saw that with like the proof of stake ICOs. They were just printing. So the way that works is as a counter to proof of work, because a lot of people were seeing this, the problem with mining proof of work Bitcoin, is it takes a lot of money to get the miners. And so it was kind of an elitist game, which was against the original ethos of the Bitcoin white paper, which the whole idea was everybody could mine on their computer and take part in that. But the programmers had changed that to ASIC mining to make it supposedly more robust and to make it more powerful for running the blockchain. But what it did is it really created a vacuum of for those that had a lot of US dollars, ironically enough, to get in and control Bitcoin. Because it took a lot of US or people that had a lot already a lot of Bitcoin, but back in the day there were Bitcoin millionaires and billionaires, but it was mostly US dollars funding the mining operations to then earn Bitcoin. So right then and there, you've got a huge red flag of like this fiat debt money system coming in and massively influencing the nature of Bitcoin. And then on top of that, you had you know, the concern. I'm not as concerned about this, but I do see valid points here on the energy waste. Of the Bitcoin mining, right? The way the competition works and the scarcity works is that it's literally built on the idea that we have scarce energy resources. And so the computing power takes energy to compete, and that requires money. And that creates a whole dynamic of an economic means of making sure that there's competition and that it maintains decentralization that way. So I was seeing all this, and I'm like, oh, okay, that's not cool. And they could lead to more centralization. There's got to be a better way. And so people were trying to think of what's a better way than proof of work, wasting all this energy, letting the rich run the blockchain. That wasn't what it was for, and potential mass centralization. So that's when proof of stake was developed. And that idea was that instead of people that have expensive mining systems running the consensus, it's just whoever is a stakeholder with coin. So if you can get coin and stake that on your computer, you are taking part in the consensus. Well, duh, there's obvious massive problems with this. This is literally centralized Fed coin 2.0, because in order to launch a coin and launch a blockchain, typically on proof of work, which is this is a good thing about proof of work, you just turn it on and you start mining. And the first person, whoever decides to start running the algorithm on their computer, they get to find the first block. then they get the first coin. And it's literally creating the coin with every block. Okay, it's people computing, and then you take the whole point of the blocks is to take all the transactions and that are encrypted and stack, put them in the single block, right? And then that's what seals that, so you know they can't be double spent. And then there's blocks on blocks on blocks that creates this solid ledger, right, of truth, supposedly, based upon computers competing. And then if you're the competing computer that wins the block, based on random chance and computation and difficulty settings, then you earn a little reward for putting the work in. That's proof of work. And so the beautiful thing about that is it allows you to start a new decentralized ledger with everybody at the same place. Everybody, you just go. And then, oh, I got the first coin. Then I got a coin. Well, proof of stake, it requires people to have coin to run the blockchain. Mm-hmm. So inherently, you have to create all the coin first. And inherently that is centralized, because that means somebody has all that coin and gets to say who gets it dished out to. And that was the initial coin offering. And so you had all these scams of people saying, well, the founders get 10%, we get this amount of coin, and you get this amount of coin, and then we just issue coin on every block that's in like a pot. And then the more you get, the more you can stake, and or they would give a ton of coin to exchanges on this initial coin offering, and then everybody would have to go put their money in to buy them. And then those exchanges were getting pieces of it. You didn't know where it was going. It was just a total train wreck. So I was like, oh, that is worse than proof of work. That is like, we've gone back to, you know, federal, you know, centralized currency. So and I'm sorry for this rant, but I think it's good for your audience to understand this, because it's really important now. Because we have literally the second largest cryptocurrency in the world. Ethereum has gone to proof of stake from proof of work. They made that changeover. Huge red flag. I see that as like the World Economic Forum blockchain. Their whole spiel is tokenizing assets. And the whole idea is that you can have stakeholder capitalism built into Ethereum because it's all proof of stake. So those that have all the most Ethereum may have the most power over the blockchain. And their whole point is to tokenize everything through, and so that all of our assets, all of our holdings, all of our ownership, be our house, our cars, our freaking kids, for all we know, will be on a blockchain that they control.
That does it for the first half of my conversation with Mike Winner. As you are inspired to pick up the rest of the conversation, you can find that on both my Patreon and Locals communities. Those addresses are dannycats.locals.com and patreon.com/dannycats. As you are also inspired to learn more about me and my work, including my books, my brand new Pop Propaganda digital media literacy course for teens and grownups, my quantum languaging webinars, as well as how to work with me one-on-one in the coaching capacity, or how to bring me into your organization as a languaging consultant, you can learn more about my work at dannycats.com as well as quantumlanguaging.com. Lastly, I am inviting you to sign up for my newsletter at dannycats.com. It is the best way to guarantee that we can stay in touch, so be sure to do that while remembering that every word matters, that you are omniscopic amazingness. Have a rockin' day.
And for clicking that subscribe button, for liking, for sharing, for commenting, and for leaving some kind words as a review, as you are authentically inspired. As you are receiving any value from my podcast, as you dig it, as you listen regularly, consider supporting me on Patreon and or Locals, where for as little as $5 a month, you get access to all of my second half podcast interviews, as well as oodles of bonus content. Your support really goes a long way in supporting me as a journalist and an independent content creator navigate her way through a really crunchy time in terms of free speech. And as you are wanting to learn more about my work in the world, my books, my products, my quantum languaging coaching and consulting, you can find me at dannycats.com as well as quantumlanguaging.com. And if you're not down with a membership
patronage platform and want to send me one-time donation, you can use the Bitcoin link if it actually appears on your podcast listening platform. You could also send me a one-time donation by way of PayPal at dannykatz@pm.me or by way of Venmo, where my username is Sadie Bloom. Again, your support means the world and makes a massive, massive difference when it comes to continuing to share this work with the world. Thank you for sharing your sacred attention with me. Thank you for remembering that you are omniscopic amazingness and for having a rockin' day. See you next time, superstars.